You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, March 20th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author, journalist Masha Gessen, author of several books, here to discuss both the way to avoid an autocracy or to deal with one and a plea to not get too caught up in the Russian conspiracy. Also on the program today, happy anniversary. 14 years since shock and awe and the start of our illegal invasion and occupation. And, well, you know, we're still there. Not in as many numbers, but... And we can go back. We still haven't taken their oil yet. There's still time.
We actually did kind of take some of their oil, but...
Some of
it. Being that isn't May.
Gorsuch, SCOTUS hearings start today on the Hill as we speak. So is Orrin Hatch speaking. Meanwhile... Just across the Capitol building, Comey et al. Testify to the House Intelligence Committee. And then, down the road, Trump rescinds an Obama student loan order. Debt collectors can now charge exorbitant fees again.
It's this sort of thing that we're looking to do at the Department of Edu-what?
And caveat emptor, Trump's approval continues to fall. The antitrust division to become the anti-antitrust division. Trump's budget, an austerity crapstorm. And Paul Ryan's protracted wet dream now includes drug tests for federal unemployment benefits.
Just human suffering. There's something about it when you don't feel anything. All of a sudden, you feel something.
Healthcare will be done in the dark of night if a bill even makes it to the floor of the House. And Trump has a team of commissars. He doesn't even trust his own picks. And finally, Donald Trump playing the part of Uber Schmuck in the Angela Merkel visit this weekend. Folks... It's just another one of those days where you have 14 different things going on. The big news that came out of this Comey thing happened just moments ago, I guess, which is really, I don't know. There was a couple of things that happened so far during this Comey thing. One is, I think it's possible that Comey inadvertently, in a conversation with Trey Gowdy, that he inadvertently managed to confirm the existence of a FISA court ruling. I don't know. I got to go back and listen to it. But in real time, that's what it sounded like. But just imagine that you have a FBI chief who has to tell... has to say these words. This is in regards to whether or not Donald Trump's tweets about Barack Obama personally wiretapping him is correct.
Director Comey, I want to begin by attempting to put to rest several claims made by the president about his predecessor, namely that President Obama wiretapped his phones. So that we can be precise, I want to refer you to exactly what the president said and ask you whether there is any truth to it. First, the president claimed, quote, terrible. Just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism, unquote. Director Comey, was the president's statement that Obama had his wires tapped in Trump Tower a true statement?
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. The Department of Justice has asked me to share with you that the answer is the same for the Department of Justice and all its components. The department has no information that supports those tweets.
There you have it.
Yo, Barack, you're dead wrong.
I don't know what to say. I mean, so apparently there's no information to support those tweets by the president of the United States.
He had the equivalent of Jim Acosta and Jake Tapper we were talking about the other day. He had the same, I'm the head of the FBI. I helped give this guy the election, for Christ's sake. And I... like
do I really
say,
have to say this?
To the ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, no, I don't think those tweets are substantive.
This is something you could have improvised like a week after the election.
Exactly.
It's crazy. All right, let's listen to one more clip from the Comey thing. We'll probably have more clips tomorrow as we weed through it. We will also have clips tomorrow of the Gorsuch hearing and the ongoing, but I will talk more about Gorsuch later in this program. Tomorrow we'll either have a quick guest or no guest, and we'll have more time to talk about this. But here is a Comey also authorized to say that the FBI is investigating possible links. Again, you know, it's very hard to know what's going on. We don't know what the hell is going on, but it's really hard to understand how this guy came out with that letter sent, and he made a point later that he was talking about a closed investigation, but I'm sorry, if you are still investigating things, you've reopened it, but it was, he claimed, without mentioning Clinton's name, that he was able to discuss this because it was a closed investigation. I still contend that the answer very well may have been that he thought this is a way to inoculate them and show that he was in no way a partisan because he anticipated Clinton winning and then having to bring charges maybe against some Trump people. I don't know. That's just one off-the-wall theory. But, you know, we may never know. But apparently, this is still happening.
As you know, our practice is not to confirm the existence of ongoing investigations, especially those investigations that involve classified matters. But in unusual circumstances, where it is in the public interest, it may be appropriate to do so, as Justice Department policies recognize. This is one of those circumstances. I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts. As with any counterintelligence investigation, this will also include an assessment of whether any crimes were committed.
So this is an ongoing investigation. He says it's going to take a long time. Didn't necessarily say it would take 8 years or 4 years or 2 years or 3 years. It appears that they're going to give more information in closed hearing. Now, understand how different this is from where we were just a month ago when Comey wouldn't tell anything to this committee, even behind closed doors. Later in the hearing, Trey Gowdy, who, you know, has spent much of the hearing almost exclusively on the idea of the leaks. How do we know this information? How do we know this about Flynn? Suggesting writing, you know, basically running off a list of nine former Obama officials who could have been the leakers, making it all about the leaking, which, you know, is obviously for political reasons. There's obviously reasons why we don't leak. But he said, Gowdy said, what possible reason could have someone have for leaking this information? Does it in any way help you in your investigation? And Comey said no. But of course, I think there is another explanation for those leaks. And it allows Comey to go in front of the Intelligence Committee and basically confirm some things. And that is, you have the recusal of Jeff Sessions. You have some space between Jeff Sessions and Comey in terms of that investigation. Now, Comey couldn't get out there and say this, I think, in any context. Well, those leaks actually did ensure that this investigation would continue and not be quashed. But his behavior has changed post Jeff Sessions' recusal. And I would suggest that's a very good reason why someone might leak or be a whistleblower. So take that for what it's worth. Keep in mind, these Gorsuch hearings are really, in many respects, more important. But first, let me ask you, are you hiring? Do you have any idea where to post your job to find the best candidates? Well, if you have a idea, you have the wrong idea, because you can't just post it at one place.
It's true. Wrong.
If you want to find the perfect hire, you got to post your job on all the top job sites. Michael, Kelly, Matt, they may not all go to the same job site. How could I assemble them all here at the same time?
And also social media.
Also social media. ZipRecruiter already has 9 million resumes you can search through in their database. Plus, one click, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media, Michael.
Hello.
He spends his whole time there. So, but
all of it. Stop talking to me.
ZipRecruiter's handy website shows trending career fields, cities, searches. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. No juggling emails or calls to your office. It's one of the best features, in my estimation. You quickly screen candidates, you rate them, you hire the right person fast. And if you run into any issues, do not fret. ZipRecruiter's friendly and human.
Big deal right there.
Yes. Support staff is ready to help. Right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Check it out. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. You can post those jobs for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Again, best time to post for a job is when you don't need to fill it. Have those candidates in the back pocket. Get a sense of what you need in that position. Meanwhile, this is unique for me. It's Monday, but I'm actually excited about dinner. Why? Why is that, Sam? Because we know you only get Blue Apron on Wednesdays and Thursdays. Maybe sometimes you drag it out to Fridays. Well, because of the snow last week, our delivery was a day late. And so what do we do? We put the other one in the fridge. It's coming up in a minute. But for less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers easy-to-follow seasonal recipes along with pre-proportioned ingredients right to your door. Less than 10 bucks a meal. You can make memorable meals yourself in under 40 minutes. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of ingredients required, they're reducing food waste. It's delicious, quality food you can feel good about. Some of the meals in March include salmon piccata with orzo and broccoli. This is what is waiting in my fridge right now. Pork chops and miso butter with bok choy and marinated apple. Yes, Jesus Christ is right. I'm so excited about that. I can't even breathe now. Vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla strips. Spicy shrimp coconut curry with cabbage and rice. Check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, now John Cornyn is talking during the Gorsuch hearings. I mean, this is...
talk about going from high to low.
Yeah.
From Blue Apron to John Cornyn.
Indeed. Big drop-off.
Very big.
Look, here's the situation with the Gorsuch hearings. You have Michael Bennett, who's going to... supposedly one of the people who introduced him, right? I missed that.
That's what I've heard.
There are deals that are supposedly being floated around. Democrats won't filibuster if McConnell promises not to nuke the filibuster next time. I mean, I don't know how many times you have to get spanked by Mitch McConnell until you realize, like, he likes to spank us.
There is some... I don't understand Democrats, man. And part of it has to be psychological pathology.
Well, I mean...
It's an addiction to rules that do not apply.
Right. I mean, I think there's some notion of, like, we've got to protect the institution. But, you know, that ball game's over. Do you know that the joke about the bear?
No, tell me.
The bear hunter?
No. Go.
You're from North Dakota. You must know this. Oh. Okay. So...
yeah, Matt.
Guy goes into the woods. He's hunting a bear. Bear comes up behind him, grabs his gun. The bear's like, oh, I mean, the hunter's like, please, oh God, don't kill me. And the bear says, I won't if you perform some type of
favor.
Yeah, favor for me.
I'm a joke and tell. I'm a professional joke teller.
Sexual favor for me.
See the structure of where
sexual favor for me.
Go.
And the guy does it. Bear walks off. The bear hunter comes back out into the woods, just. With his gun, bear sees him again, grabs the gun. Guy's like, please don't kill me. Bear says, all right, but you know what? You know the deal. You got to provide a sexual favor for me. And then the bear lets him go. Third time, hunter comes out there with a gun. Bear sneaks up on him again, grabs the gun. He goes, you're not out here hunting bears, are you?
Exactly.
And
exactly.
At one point, you got to wonder what the Democrats are doing, right? And I think that's a legitimate concern.
Oh, I'll admit we're not out hunting
However,
bears.
And frankly, you know, there hasn't been, have we heard anything about these Gorsuch hearings? I mean, the problem is like, you know, I think the Democrats, Chuck Schumer is running around like a chicken with his head cut off, or just running around, or not running around at all, just a chicken who's had his head cut off and who's now dead, doing nothing. And Democrats need to filibuster. So you need to maintain. Right now, I believe there's 40 votes. You need to maintain a filibuster by maintaining 40 votes, 41 votes. And the question is, they can lose 5 or 6 here. And it's not clear where they're at yet. So continue to call your Senate, your senators, tell them to filibuster Gorsuch. I mean, he will get in anyways, because then Mitch McConnell will then nuke the filibuster and Gorsuch will get in. But we might as well get it over with now. Might as well make them pay the price.
And by the way, I'm not in any way to justify, you know, because the other extreme is obviously, you know, people who didn't take the Supreme Court seriously, which is totally inexcusable. But they do have a point when they say that, like, this is the line in all of the DNC, you know, in all of the fundraising emails, like the Supreme Court, you know, maybe you might have to let go voting to confirm a HUD secretary that's incompetent or something. But we're really here on the Supreme Court. Like, if you're not going to go to war now, when would it ever be?
Indeed.
You're talking about getting rid of Roe v. Wade. You're talking, I mean, everything is on the table. So
everything's
if you
on
don't
the table.
Do it now, you're just not even demonstrating the basic function of why you exist as a party.
I agree. And again, I know there were some people out there who thought that somehow the Democrats would be able to prevent these hearings or that they would go on and guaranteed filibuster and somehow that filibuster would be maintained. I don't know how that would happen. But this is predictable. You know, in these situations, Democrats don't play defense terribly well.
Or offense.
Or offense.
We just don't do things too good.
All right. Had an interesting conversation with Masha Gessen, who is a journalist and author, on Friday. Want to play that today. You know, people keep hoping that this Russia thing will be a silver bullet. And the bottom line is that the Republicans will not impeach Donald Trump, short of him being indicted or running around naked on the White House lawn. Now that there is room for Comey to pursue this investigation, there's nothing more to be done here from a political standpoint. There's nothing more to be done. People have to focus on things like the actual existence of an administration and a party that is assaulting our government and, frankly, the American people. I mean, rolling back student loan orders so debt collectors can charge more exorbitant fees. Drug testing, people receiving federal unemployment benefits. This is just the beginning. People better start paying attention to this. I mean, this Russia stuff sucked the oxygen out of this Gorsuch hearing.
And believe it or not, normal people are more concerned about student loan ripoffs and women's health than conspiracies.
But the fact of the matter is Gorsuch will be around for decades after you've forgotten every single person who said a word in today's Russia hearing.
I almost feel like I need to create a conspiracy theory that Gorsuch talked to the Russians just to get the Democrats to take the hearing seriously. It's like, wait a second, Gorsuch met with the Russians?
Yeah.
We got to do something about this.
Right, exactly. All right, but we're going to take a break. Here is this interview I did on Friday, pre-record with Masha Gessen, and we'll be back in a few. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program author and journalist Masha Gessen, whose latest book, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, will be coming out later in this year. Masha, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I wanted to talk to you actually about two pieces that you have written that sort of the first and the most recent piece for the New York Review of Books, one right after Donald Trump was elected, entitled Autocracy Rules for Survival, and the most recent, Russia, the Conspiracy Trap. And I want to just start with the reasons why you wanted to write Rules for Survival of an Autocracy, those five steps, and I want to go through some of them, but do you have...
Six.
Do you have a perspective... Has your perspective on the potential for the Trump administration, the Trump era, to become autocratic, has that changed at all over the past 3 or 4 months?
Not at all. I actually think that so far, unfortunately, my initial perception was quite accurate. He did run for autocrat, and he is trying to establish an autocracy. I mean, he probably doesn't think of it that way. He probably thinks of running the country like he runs a business. But in the end, you know, it's despotic one-person rule.
And I guess, you know, as we go through some of these six steps, is my asking falling into a trap even of one of the sort of the potential pitfalls? In other words, do we become desensitized to these things?
I think we inevitably become desensitized to these things, you know, and it would be unreasonable to ask ourselves not to become desensitized people do need to sort of change and adapt. That's part of who we are as humans. I think that, you know, I just am advocating being conscious of our adaptations and knowing, you know, trying to keep in mind what's not normal.
How do these things play out? I mean, like, what's the first? I mean, obviously, we have a Donald Trump whose perception of the way government should work basically is that what he says goes, right? I mean, we even see this as in the context of his attacks on the judiciary, his seeming frustration with the idea of a legislative process. But what is it, like, mechanically, what happens? What's the first indication that this is spreading beyond him?
I don't know that, why are you asking if we need, what the first indication that this is spreading beyond him is? I don't understand the question. Why does it need to spread beyond him?
Well, I guess my question is, like, are there mechanics to an autocratic rule? I mean, it's one thing for him to be frustrated that the legal system is not backing him up. It's one thing for him to be frustrated that he's not getting his way. But it seems to me another that the force of what he's trying to do then starts to break down some of these checks and balances.
Right. So now I get the question. Well, of course, I mean, from the very beginning, right, when he started nominating his people for cabinet positions, for one thing, you know, these are people who are demonstrably unfit for the jobs that they're supposed to do. Most of them are, in fact, outspoken opponents of the very existence of the agencies that they're supposed to run, which we now also see reflected in Trump's budget and in legislation that has been introduced recently. Not only that, that will be sort of half bad, but the fact that none of his nominees went through the regular ethics vetting process, which is not a law, right? It's a norm, which is a reason that he was able to ignore the regular procedure of putting people through the ethics vetting process. And of course, the fact that he's got a Republican Congress also allowed him to ignore that safeguard. But that's one example of a safeguard that we thought we had, right? Just
right.
Because everyone else had observed it and it disappeared. Another is starting on his very first day in the White House, you know, calling the press, the opposition party, and acting to marginalize and discredit the media every day since he's been in office is another way. I mean, the national press is a very important part, one of the most important parts of the American system of checks and balances. That's breaking down. I mean, you can't, you know, their journalists are certainly fighting valiantly for good coverage, to do good coverage of this administration. There's some incredible and vigorous stuff coming out, but ultimately, in an administration that discredits the media, that that will not talk to people through the media, that will only use Twitter to talk to people, that's an administration that's weakening a most important institution of American democracy.
And I mean, I've been struck by how little people talk about the idea that he would divest himself from his companies since essentially the day after the inauguration, when it was clear that he wasn't going to. It is almost completely, I mean, I feel like that is palpable, this idea that we have already traded away certain norms of conflict of interest. That seems to be completely out the window now.
Absolutely. I mean, he showed a bunch of empty folders on TV, and that was that. And even if folders weren't empty, we have no idea if they were, but even if they weren't empty, what he said was, woefully inadequate to the situation. He is not divesting. There are conflicts of interest. He is receiving remuneration from foreign governments, right, in violation of the Constitution. There's a lawsuit pending in New York State, and maybe eventually it will produce something. But basically, that yeah, that norm is out the window.
Rule number two that you had listed in your piece was do not be taken in by small signs of normality. And I guess, you know, to some extent, we have, I mean, as a society, I feel like to a large extent, we have done that. I mean, you know, people talk about now the stock market rising as if there's a certain segment of our population that is seeing ostensibly is seeing this as all sort of beneficial and seeing that as an indication that everything is going to be more or less within the margins of what we're used to.
Right. Well, think about the his address to Congress and how overjoyed everybody was that it wasn't as right. big an embarrassment, as big a horror show as the inauguration or his 51-minute press conference, right? The fact that he stuck to his text that he read from a teleprompter was enough to convince Van Jones that
right.
Trump had become presidential. I mean, that was an incredibly disheartening spectacle for me that whole evening. And I think that to a large extent, we've sort of avoided being taken in by normality, by signs of normality, because he has moved so fast. I mean, I didn't expect him to move so fast. I didn't expect him to be such a bull in a china shop. But he has. So there's been a little sort of a level of disbelief and outrage among a large number of people on a daily basis since he took office. And then, you know, for an hour or 2 hours, he talks and walks like kind of sort of a human being, not a particularly likable human being, but you know, at least like not a deranged man. And everybody breathes relief. You know, like the nightmare is over.
You can sense. I mean, I mean that's a great point, man. That was a real sense that there was almost a desperation for him to sort of indicate to all of us that it's going to be okay. I mean, we're recording this on Friday, and we looked at a tape of Jim Acosta and Jake Tapper from CNN, sort of both talking to each other in astonishment at the refusal of Donald Trump to basically retract his claim that President Obama had personally wiretapped him or ordered a wiretap. And they also, there's a quality of like, they just want him to be somewhat normal. And at the same time, they're not really fully, it seems to me, absorbing the implications of that charge.
It's a really, really hard thing to, I mean, we're all, you know, in a position of a kid who's being bullied in a playground. Like, what do you do? You know, this guy is holding your hat in his right hand and you're like, give me my hat back. And he says, I didn't take your hat. You took my hat. And you're like, when did I take your hat? And he says, you took my hat in fifth grade and you didn't even go to fifth grade, right? You're a fourth grader, but you are completely helpless in that situation. When somebody refuses to acknowledge that there's such a thing as a common reality, that there's such a thing as fact, that there's such a thing as truth, when somebody is constantly engaged in a power game of asserting, you know, rule over reality, there's nothing you can do about it. So when you say that that we're failing to absorb it, you're right, but like, how do we absorb it? How do you live with something that's impossible to live with? And it's a total trap because on the one hand, I want to, you know, slap Jim Acosta across the face and say, look, this man hasn't, you know, opened his mouth and told the truth ever. Why are you being so surprised? On the other hand, if he actually comes to accept it, I'll be like, wait a second. Why are you accepting the fact that we have a liar for a president, like an intentional, abusive liar for a president? So we're really, you know, damned either way.
So what? So in that scenario, I mean, what is the answer? Is it having to sort of live with that tension constantly and somehow figure out a way to not have that tension? I mean, you know, I feel like each work week now is like 10 days long. Is it figuring out how to deal with that tension and not have it completely overwhelm us as citizens, as journalists, as whatever function that we are in society?
I think we have to try to figure out what's important and sort of stick to it. In my mind, there's no doubt that what's important is preserving our political space. And that's, you know, that's a much tougher job than you might think, because it's being debased by constant lies, right? It's also being debased by just an actual sort of attempt to destroy politics as we've done it by saying, you know, do what I say, and the president will not be questioned. And ignoring, ignoring reality in the political process, like when CBO comes out with a rating of the Trump care Ryan care plan, and the White House immediately responds by saying, "Well, CBO doesn't know what it's talking about."
Right.
So nothing. I mean, they're creating a situation where nothing matters except their victory. We have to figure out a way to hold on to public discourse in a way that also doesn't ignore the reality of what they're doing. And I don't have an answer, right? But I'm trying to at least sort of define a goal, right? What are we trying to preserve for the after Trump period, which will eventually come no matter what happens, right? Do we go into that? Are we going to emerge out the other end as this country of conspiracy thinking and debased discourse, or are we going to come out with a badly damaged but basically intact democracy? That's really the question, right? If we keep going into conspiracy theories and into trying to create, you know, grounds for impeachment by proving his connection to Russia, I think we're doing really badly. If we try to maintain healthy debate, I think we're probably doing better. But again, it has to take into account the reality that we're facing. I was just listening to a podcast where some really, really smart people were talking about the healthcare plan, like business as usual, sort of talking about the healthcare plan, talking about how Trump's constituents are going to respond to losing their healthcare, and how in the end he will be damaged by if the healthcare plan passes, which to my mind is not engaging with the current reality. Right? They basically misunderstand the way that the demagogue appeals to his voters, which is very different from the sort of the transactional thing that they imagine, where people actually make a connection between Trump and things that they lose because of Trump's actions, which I think is extremely, extremely unlikely to happen. Right. So we have to kind of set that kind of reasoning aside and yet, you know, try to deal with what's out there in the political space.
So, there's a couple of things, because it gives us an opportunity to sort of circle around through your most recent piece about getting caught up in the conspiracy trap. But if you could have jumped onto that podcast and made it more explicit to them, because it sounds to me that, There's been a healthy amount of research that suggests that we have anywhere from 20 to 25% right wing authoritarians in North America, and some non insignificant number of left authoritarians as well, in terms of followers. But the you're suggesting that the calculation that even if this healthcare budget was to go through and you did have all those people that, you know, West Virginia town hall lose their health insurance, that to the extent that they're supportive of Donald Trump already, he has a rather easy time of making it clear that they didn't lose it because of him. And I think to a certain extent, we're already seeing, you know, some people saying like, you know, the jobs are coming back. 2 months of job growth under Donald Trump. He's, you know, everything he said is coming true. I mean, is our system capable? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's classic, you know, that's classic for all presidents, right? All presidents, if they come in when the economy is doing well, they will ride the wave of whatever the predecessor did, right? I mean, that happens all over the world, and it certainly happened in this country over and over again. But what I think, you know, we saw this effect in when people were voting for Trump, right? Because sort of the initial assumption was, oh, Trump voters are people who have, you know, who have lost income, who are doing badly economically. A closer look shows that no, that's not true. Right? Certainly, some of his voters are people who have not done well economically, but a lot of his voters are actually, you know, have a higher than average income, and haven't done poorly themselves. Right. Right? There's been some really interesting research looking at what kind of areas those people come from, right? They often are people who are with higher than average income who live in areas where a majority of people are downwardly economically mobile. I think that's really interesting, right? That's, that shows a disconnect between their personal experience and sort of their experience of context. Their personal experience is that sort of in quote unquote objective measure, they are better off. But their subjective experience, because of their context, is that they're worse off, that life is getting worse, life is getting less predictable, life is getting more frightening. That's where you get, you know, your authoritarian voters, people who are looking for a way to gain some certainty, to gain some traction with reality. That's very different from sort of the transactional imagination of how American voters make their decisions. They've never made their decisions, you know, with their pocketbook. That's a total myth. I mean, we've known that for a long time, that the people don't make rational decisions at the polling place. But we really have to face that fact now, because a lot of the logic of political punditry, and some of the logic of the political process, is that people make, you know, these rational, transactional voting decisions. And Trump has shown us that they haven't, and Trump is going to continue to show us that they don't.
And so the notion, I mean, that's a fascinating point about that contextual dynamic. These people are feeling a greater threat because they're looking around. They may be on a raft, but they're looking around at people who are drowning. And to some extent, they're looking for someone to just simply say, I'm going to protect you from the threat, which is either, you know, the forces that are drowning the other people, or maybe the drowning people themselves who could represent that threat. You've written that the Russia conspiracy is a trap. Will you elaborate on that notion, that pursuing a sort of extra political agenda as a way of fighting Trump is the wrong way to go? Why is that?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is that I think it's doomed. The dream behind the pursuit of the Russia conspiracy, and this is, you know, all the activists and journalists who I have talked to who are really doggedly pursuing it, are single-minded in the idea that if they manage to show enough of a Russia connection, if they will succeed in sullying Trump enough to make him impeachable by a Republican Congress. Hmm. I think that's a pipe dream. Right? First of all, there's no way to make him impeachable by a Republican Congress, partly because voters don't particularly care about his Russia connection. It's much more of a Washington sort of myth of that he will be so sullied. Second of all, because the likelihood of actually digging something up that is conclusive in any way, that is strong enough to prove a connection that would even begin to sort of sully him, that probability is negligible. Now, I'm not even getting into an argument about whether some sort of conspiracy or collusion existed. So far, we haven't seen any evidence of it. I'm not saying it's impossible, but the idea that we will find eventually that there will be eventually conclusive evidence, you know, that idea is a pipe dream. But an even bigger concern for me is the damage that all this digging is doing to our discourse. Right? Politics is what's done out in the open. When some of our best journalists are devoting their energy to trying to find a secret, reveal a secret that will solve everything, that will explain how Trump happened to us, and also will make this nightmare end, that just sends us down this conspiratorial rabbit hole that detracts from our ability to protect the political space that Trump is threatening. So it's like we're doing his job for him. And what I've seen really disturbing is that this conspiratorial worldview has already led to a rise of quote-unquote fake news on the left. What's really interesting is that, you know, during the election, the Democratic part of the blogosphere was not particularly susceptible to fake news. It's not that there weren't efforts to float stuff. It just didn't get a lot of traction, didn't get a lot of shares. So it wasn't profitable. The right was really susceptible to fake news. That's why it was so profitable for Macedonian teenagers to endlessly produce these absurd stories or pick them up from elsewhere and place them on their websites, because they got so many shares that they made money off of clicks. That's changed. Now there's an incredible amount of just bizarre stuff that sometimes bubbles up and makes it onto MSNBC and CNN. Most of the time stays in the blogs, stays in the social networks and on weirdo websites, but gets a lot of shares. And there are a lot of people who are, you know, down the rabbit hole of proving that every Russian who dies on this earth was somehow connected to the Trump election. Mm.
And surely that comes out of just a sense of desperation, right? Like that there is, we're going to need a silver bullet because there is no other way to fight Donald Trump, right? And to my mind, I mean, this is a evidence of a major failure from the Democratic Party, which is ostensibly the opposition, right? I mean, you know, I think Bernie Sanders is out there, but there's recently elected DNC chair, but there's no opposition that's out there fighting, you know, really on any terms. Is just basically this, this low grade fever about a Russian conspiracy. But you're saying that even if there are some of these connections, that it is not as fruitful, both in the short term and in terms of the long run, in terms of like maintaining our democracy and fighting back against Trump.
Well, so I'm saying that there are two. It appeals on two counts, right? It's an imaginary silver bullet, and it's also an imaginary explanation.
Right.
And it promises to tell us that Americans didn't really elect Trump, that the Russians elected Trump. We really need to squarely face the fact that Americans elected Trump, and go beyond, you know, hand wringing. And talking about either, you know, how we need to be empathetic with the rural whites on the one hand, or how we don't need to be empathetic with anybody because they're all racist and deplorables. Both of those positions have merit, but we really have to move beyond them, because Trump is a reality. And it, you know, again, this we need to engage him and his voters and his cabinet and his allies in Congress in the political space, not in the behind the scenes, not in constantly trying to figure out, you know, who elected him or who's really running the country. That's another like lovely trope. It's really President Bannon.
Right.
No, it's really President Trump, who has Steve Bannon as his right hand. But it's really President Trump. Stop looking for secrets and explanations. You know, engage.
Is there a tension between, I mean, like, this was my concern following the election, that you either fight against the an autocratic rule, right, which involves don't normalize and all these other things that you've talked about, versus you fight in a against him politically. In other words, like, you know, I might think that the best way to fight Donald Trump from a political standpoint is to cleave him from the Republican Party. The more conflict there is between Donald Trump and Paul Ryan, the better it is to stop things like the budget, to stop things like the destruction of Medicaid, et cetera, et cetera. However, if I do that, it may involve, in some ways, normalizing Trump, right? Because if you're going to pull him away from the Republican Party, you can't do that by calling him a freak. Because like you say, the Republicans are not going to impeach this guy. I think the only scenario I've been able to come up is if there is like videotape of him running naked across the front lawn of the White House, you know, in broad daylight. But beyond that, I don't see...
He will say he was hacked, yeah.
Right. He'll say it was my body double. We've hired him, Sean Spicer, right. Whatever it is. But so is there a tension there? I mean, is there a... And my concern has also been that if you pursue one of those avenues, you are not only ignoring the other avenue, but in some way feeding into a bad result in that other sort of plane. Like, can these fights... to fight against an autocracy and also to fight in a sort of a more traditional political, like, I don't want austerity. Can those two things coexist?
That's a great question. I mean, you're right. There's definitely a tension. And we have to find a way to do both at the same time. And I think that way is to think a little bit less about fighting Trump and a little bit more about promoting an alternative to Trump, right? Which right now is nowhere to be seen. There's no one person. There's no vision. There's no nothing coming from the Democratic side of the aisle, except maybe a Russia conspiracy.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the idea that we go to Chuck Schumer's website, healthcare proposal is just to protect the Affordable Care Act. It just seems to me to be a really tough thing to sort of. You've got to play some offense, Masha Gessen. If there's anything else you want to mention, please do. But I really appreciate your time today. And we'll link to both those pieces and more.
Thank you so much. This was great.
All right, folks. We will link to both those pieces at majority.fm. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half. Just been listening during that interview, of course, as it was a pre-tape. I was listening to Sheldon Whitehouse, who... just delivered a scathing indictment of, frankly, the Supreme Court, or the Roberts Court, which has, without exception, ruled in favor of corporations over individuals, ruled in favor of the police over defendants. Ruled in favor of corporations against workers. I mean, we could just go on and on. He outlined the tremendous amount of dark money that has poured into judicial picks and court system on the right. And he basically said, look, and he's one of those institutionalists. He's basically said, look, I generally give the benefit of the doubt, but we got burned with Roberts, who was just going to call balls and strikes. And White House doesn't seem to have any interest in it. So call your Senate offices today. Call any of the Senate Judiciary Committee members. Tell them, filibuster. Make Mitch McConnell attack the filibuster. He doesn't want to do that. Make him do it. Because there's no use in having a filibuster if you're not going to use it for a guy who, according to some research I saw today, is to the right of anybody else on that court. Not to mention, also seems to have a problem with women.
Wait
one
a
of his
second.
Former it's students.
Interesting guy.
One of his former students has come out and complained or retold the story about where he chastised his class at Georgetown for not conceding that they all knew women who had abused their companies for maternity benefits.
Come on, admit it.
Took the maternity benefits and then left. Just didn't come back.
Take the maternity and run. It's an old saying. Oh my God. We all do it.
Those poor, poor corporations. Left there.
Neil, I personally don't trust anything that bleeds once a month and doesn't die. What about you?
Oh, exactly, Mr. President. That's really what I was trying to say at Georgetown.
Oh, my arm.
Oh,
please don't squeeze my hand.
Well, sexist enough.
But look, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you don't even have to talk about Neil Gorsuch to filibuster him. You can just simply talk about Merrick Garland. You can just simply say, like, this process, we're not engaging it. No. Done.
Good morning, Mr. Gorsuch. Garland, Merrick Garland, Garland, Merrick
right.
Garland,
exactly.
Garland, Merrick Garland, and Merrick Garland.
I hope somebody asked him the question. We'll, of course, go through all this, and we will talk about it tomorrow. In the meantime, we're going to head to the fun half, wherein we will take your phone calls, wherein we will read your IMs, wherein we will play some sound. Apparently, according to my friend... my friend Larry, who is now basically a stringer for the show, as far as I can tell. he wants me to clip Nunez asking the guy from the NSA who had already said, I can't speak to that since it's domestic intel you're talking about. Nunez apparently does not get that the NSA does not engage in domestic spying.
What does that mean, man? What are you talking about?
And apparently and that Trump is now on a Twitter storm.
Of course. But you know what I like about Nunez, though, is that can mean two things. That can mean that he's inadvertently revealing more NSA programs that he's privy of that totally do engage domestic spying, which is very possible. Or he's just a complete moron.
He is. Trump is now saying that Comey refuses to deny he briefed President Obama on calls made by Michael Flynn to Russia. The amazing thing is that Trump fired Flynn. Right? I mean,
didn't feel good about it.
Made me do it. Made me do it. NSA and FBI tell Congress Russia did not influence the electoral process. That's a lie. They just simply said they didn't have evidence of it.
Same difference. Right, Neil? And he's a judge.
Wow. This is freaking out, Larry. That's all I'm going to tell you.
Let me tell you something. Until you've seen a woman hustle you for that maternity leave, right after the kid's born, you have not seen a real pool shark. Neil Gorsuch's a genius.
Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. And when you become a member of the program at jointhemajorityreport.com, we give you a bonus almost every day of an hour, sometimes an hour and a half, sometimes 45 hours. Sometimes we accidentally
sometimes
do a 24-hour marathon.
Sometimes it just goes on endlessly.
And
hold on. Let me get to this last diagram.
6 years of...
It's 6:30. Okay, give me a letter. But wait a second. I just wanted to get to this other thing because they were going to cut the program from the EPA and it's and Jimmy Dore and
there's
everyone
so
else. And okay, it's
so
7:15
much.
Now.
There's so much news now that it's... you know, it's the only way we get through it. But and if you're one of those people who are going through some difficult times financially, don't hesitate to email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com and ask us to make a deal if you want the fun half. We will always make a deal with you. And,
plus
you know,
it,
if it takes a while...
Not as much as a deal. It's just...
It's a deal. We make a deal.
I think you're getting into Trump territory there.
No, we make a deal. We make a deal.
What's the
deal?
They have to do like hard labor for you, like
yes.
It
clean your windows.
Some
or
don't,
like,
don't reveal that publicly.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to negotiate
all of these,
against myself.
All of these destitute Americans doing labor at Sam's properties.
I'm not
going to
negotiate against
half.
Myself. Some people I say, tell your friends. Other people I say, spread the word around school. It depends on where they're from. I'm not going to negotiate
against
myself.
Other people say,
right now.
Go catch that raccoon that's attacking the cats.
It's right. 7:45 now. We have time for one more call.
All right.
Wait, you're talking about light mass energy? Go on for 20 minutes, please.
We're going to find out about that.
If you were saying something that made sense, I'd rush you right off.
We're going to find out about that. Supposedly, they're coming out with the machines, right? This year. I mean... Matt and I are skeptical. We're skeptical.
Bit skeptical. It's about dark matter.
I like how Matt
is. It's skeptical.
Bit skeptical. Every time there's a call like that, I always get the Matt I am. He never I am. I beg to get Matt's attention during the rest of the show. Like, hey, turn on the board. Get ready to the style clip. He's zoning off. And then as soon as there's a call like that, I get 50, like, bit skeptical. Dark matter.
All right.
Not
point
true.
Is, become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. Get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon or Jet, do so at our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You can click on those links, bookmark it. Always use that as your Amazon or your Jet link. We get a kickback. And don't forget the member show, commercial free. All right, folks, be right back after this, 646-257-3920.